I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello! You must be sick of the sight of me. I never go away. I've actually brought a sleeping bag and I'm just going to stay in the scriptorium from now on. It's just pointless leaving. What an evening. Better week. Every day I think it can't get any better, and it gets better. And I'm goosebumpy from today. I can't believe it's ending tomorrow. I'm going to be slightly in grief when it's all gone. But tonight is particularly exciting for me because I reached out to a dear friend, Anita, and she is so busy. This woman never stops. She's in different countries. She's all over the world. And she said she would come and talk to us tonight, which is, again, I'm so grateful. I've got a few logistical things to do. There will be book signings, I think. I think my books are up there, weirdly, if you want them. I don't know. I'm amazed if anybody in Gloucester doesn't own a copy of my book by now. But there are copies up there. We will be taking questions. So we'll do sort of 45, 50 minutes of talking to each other. And then it will go out to you guys. So wait for the microphone to reach you. Someone will bring it over. Speak into the microphone. Then we can hear you. I want to thank everybody that's been involved in this festival. Tomorrow I'm going to do the big list of thank yous where I get very tearful and say how magnificent the team are that put this festival on for you and how hard they all work. But it would be impossible to do this without our sponsors. And we are so fortunate that companies from Gloucester, people, they want to sponsor these talks. And in particular, we've got Davis and Partners Solicitors sponsoring tonight. Now, they have been with us since day one, and they believe in this festival, and that is why they continue to invest in it, and I'm incredibly grateful to them for that. Right, Anita, what can I say? You all know her. She is a superstar. I idolise this woman. Not only is she one of the most extraordinary broadcasters in terms of her humanity and her just the sheer approachability of her on the screen. I feel like every time I watch Anita on the screen, she's talking to me. And that is such a gift. And she's incredibly talented and gifted for that. She's incredibly intelligent and just so good at what she does. But she's also been on Strictly Come Dancing. And I mean, she can dance. It's not fair. One person shouldn't have all those skills. It's just not fair. So we are going to be talking about quite an upsetting topic today. And it's something that you'll find out why she chose to talk about this today and how it came about. But we are going to be talking about Indian partition. So sit back, relax, and please, let's all welcome to the stage the amazing Anita Ronnie.
Thank you. What an intro.
Yeah, well,
that was quite difficult.
It.
I have to say, Nina's given me this huge intro, but obviously I'm the fan of Nina because I've come dressed identically. I've got boot envy. Hello, everyone. How wonderful to be in Gloucester. My first time here, and it's...
No.
Yeah, honestly, and I do travel the length and breadth of the country, and I'm always somewhere incredible for Countryfile or wherever, but first time in Gloucester, and This Blackfriars Priory is just spectacular. What a great venue.
It is amazing. And that is why we're doing the History Festival, because not enough people have come here, not enough people know what we've got to offer, and that's why we want to shout about it. And you are helping us
with that.
Thank you.
I know, a bit of Yorkshire in Gloucester.
I know. It's good. So, okay,
yes.
We're going to be going on a long journey together on this stage. I want to find out first, before we go into the story of what happened, a bit about your early life. So tell me what it was like growing up as Anita Rani.
Oh, gosh. So I grew up in Bradford and in Yorkshire. My grandfather, the one you don't know about, because you know a bit about half of my family, my maternal side. But the reason that I lived in Bradford is because my grandfather, my dad's dad, was one of the first wave of Indian migrants to Britain, and he came in 1954 as an economic migrant, post-partition, as lots of people from the Commonwealth were invited over to help rebuild Britain. My granddad decided to come, and he worked in a foundry, and he's told me all this, and my first question was, Granddad, why Bradford? You could have gone anywhere. But actually, having said that, I joke, I'm so proud of my northern roots. And for me, being from Yorkshire, I'm so lucky to be from a county that has such a strong identity. And you cut me and I bleed Yorkshire, Punjabi, London. It's kind of a nice mixture. But I had a really lovely childhood. My dad got married to my mum, arranged marriage. First time they met, at Heathrow Airport.
Wow.
Amazing, right?
Gosh.
And that's another conversation for another day.
That is.
But it is, and they are the most remarkable people I know. They're incredible. Really? They're just a force. And, they built me to kind of, I just saw them work really hard to give me and my brother a brilliant life. But also they were adventurous, and we'd go out into the countryside every weekend, and we would be on the moors or visiting Whitby and York and all these fabulous places. So I guess that's where the country file kind of in me comes from. So very much a city girl, but have such a huge appreciation of the countryside.
Yeah, because you do so many different programs.
Yes.
And I mean, that's again what sort of excites me about your work, is that you're equally passionate. You know, you could be rambling along next to a river getting utterly excited about it, or like you've just been doing with World's Busiest Cities, in the heart of sewers and dumps.
I know how I got the sewer gig. I'm sure the contract said Dan Snow goes in the sewers, not Anita Rani. I don't do sewers. But yeah, it was pretty stinky. I do a lot of stuff. I'm really lucky, I guess, when you work in television, to get that variety of programs. When I'm not a formidable expert, you know, renowned historian as yourself, some of us have got to blag our way through life, right?
Perfect.
And so, two things. I am genuinely passionate about everything. And also, I'm pretty cheap. I'll do anything for the right price. So...
I don't believe that.
I'm lucky I get to do some really good stuff.
But it's for the adventure too, isn't it? I mean, that is the thing about making television, that, you know, it is so exciting to have these opportunities and the access, it's the things that people don't get to see, and you're taking people with you on that journey.
It's absolutely wonderful that I get to travel, and I do get to travel the world, and I absolutely love it because I have... wanderlust eternally. I don't think it will ever leave me.
Really?
But even just for country file, going around Britain, and it's the same thing, to be invited into people's homes to really see a slice of life that you wouldn't see. And it's so annoying for my husband, because I can't go on holiday without going, oh, if only I was working here, I'd be invited into their home. And I'd get to, like, and I'm actually being a tourist now, and that's really tough, because
I queued to pay to get into a museum the other day, and I'm like, what is this?
How do I not just walk straight? But that is the biggest privilege. Because personally you get to see bits of the world that you wouldn't get to see as a tourist. But B, that people actually invite you in.
And
that's what is so remarkable about humans, but also it's so humbling. And that's what I take away from everything that I do, that people are just wonderful wherever you go, and they will bring you into their home. And one of the most brilliant programs I did was straight after Strictly, which is brilliant, and again, another conversation of the day, and I'm sure maybe someone may have a question about it. But it's such a bubble. And the first program I did as soon as that finished was I went to a refugee camp called Zaatari in Jordan, a Syrian refugee camp. And that was the place where I felt the most humble. I could have just crawled on my hands and knees, because we know they have nothing, and yet nobody would. They had. It's an incredible place. They have a high street where they have bakeries and the most delicious falafel you've ever had, and a wedding dress shop and a bicycle repairman. So they've created this environment so that they can, you know, just have a semblance of normality. And yet, everywhere we went, we'd say, right, we need to buy some baklava to do some filming. And they wouldn't accept our money.
Gosh.
Yeah, I know. I mean, these are small things, gosh, but these are the things that I take away from the jobs that
absolutely.
I do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it is. It's just the more people you meet, the richer you actually find people.
Yes.
I find as well.
I love people.
Yeah. I think we have that in common.
Yeah. Apart from Trump.
He's in another box. He's in a box of a few that we don't like.
There's a few,
We'll just chuck a few in there. Now, I want to talk about these programs that you've made that mean so much to you, and particularly mean a lot to, I think, the viewing public. You have had the most extraordinary reception for your documentaries, India and Me, that went out, and I'm sure many of you will have watched them. Utterly amazing television. I said to her upstairs, I was so proud of you in every single shot. It was so human and so personable. And you were telling a story that very few people know about. Tell us about it.
So this, well, with the, yeah, we will talk, obviously we're going to talk about actually partition, but and what I know about it through making these programs. But where the program idea came from was 2 years ago, I was lucky enough to be asked by the BBC to, if I wanted to make a Who Do You Think You Are? I don't know, some of you may have seen my episode. And I knew a little bit about my family, but I didn't know a great deal. I knew that my grandfather was in the British Indian Army and had been married and had a son. And at the point of partition, which is when the British Raj ended and the British left India and Pakistan was created, we will cover this ground again. I feel like, how do I tell this story?
How do I tell the whole story of partition? Yeah.
But what I knew is that at that moment, he lost his first family. Everybody died. And he remarried my mum's mum, my nan, and that's where my mum and I come from. But that's all we knew. And Who Do You Think You Are? We know is a wonderful way of learning about other history that wouldn't be told otherwise, just through this brilliant technique that some genius in television had the idea of doing. And the only reason, there's a real difficulty in telling stories that aren't from Europe, if you come from Africa or Asia, is because there's no documentation. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of oral history, but actually to make a TV program like Who Do You Think You Are, you need documents.
Good point, yeah.
And the only reason they could tell my story is because my grandfather was in the British Indian Army, that they had documentation of his life and his career, and that because the British were there and they were so amazing at documenting things and keeping records and filing things, even though the Indian filing system is a world of its own. But that's the only reason. I mean, that might, you know, maybe I'll make another program about my nan who grew up in Burma, and I'm desperate to know about her life in Burma, but they couldn't find any documents to support what they'd been up to. So I made this Who Do You Think You Are, and I can quite honestly say, I think it changed my life. It really did. I went into this program saying, I'd quite like to know, but you know, my mum and dad are the reason I am who I am. And I think as a migrant, from a migrant family, you kind of just think, well, you know, we go back as far as I can, we're here on these shores.
Exactly, yeah.
And what happened over there, what will I learn about myself? Oh, more fool me.
Really?
Not only did I discover so much about my grandfather and who he was as a human and what a progressive, incredible man he was, he kept a memoir. As a man of his generation, the Second World War generation, I think we all know that generation are very stoic, resilient, and men particularly just don't talk. They certainly don't talk about their feelings and emotions, let alone an Indian man of that generation. But he wrote a memoir in both English and Punjabi.
Good grief.
And it is the most beautifully poetic piece of what I got to read. It was just incredible, and I felt so proud to come from that man. I'm kind of like thinking, where do I go back to partition? There's so much to say.
But you made the Who Do You Think You Are,
yes.
And obviously it opened up this whole world of your maternal grandfather.
Yes.
And And in a way, the real crux of that story was this incredibly dramatic event
Absolutely.
That affected him early in his life. And that you then ran with
Yes.
and said, I want to explore this more.
And that happened really quickly. That happened whilst I was filming the program. So
Really?
I'm in India and everyone's saying, this is your grandfather. I'm like, yeah, he's amazing. Wow, he wrote this memoir. And I remember talking to a historian, one of you talked to so many when you were making the program. Very quickly, I think within the first few days, I realized, it dawned on me that this is so much bigger than me. Mm. I am not telling my story. Mm. I'm telling the story of millions of people. And obviously, growing up in Britain, you grow up in a community. And I grew up surrounded by, especially in a small town like Bradford, a city like Bradford, in the 80s, all the Asians were together. And I don't just mean Punjabi Indians like my family. I mean the Punjabi Pakistanis, and everybody would know each other. Mm. It's like, my God, every single one of these families went through this.
Yeah.
Why does no one talk about this? Like, why? Even my own family has kept absolute silence about the fact that my grandfather had a daughter, that what happened to his wife. No one really knows what happened. Nobody has spoken about it. The program went out, and I got this overwhelming reaction, and which really threw me, actually, because I thought, oh, no one's going to watch it. No one's really interested.
It was absolutely off the stratosphere. It just
yeah.
went. And everyone was so excited, because I think the problem is, as well, it's an anniversary, isn't it? It's 70 years
yeah.
since the Independence Act was passed. And as a result, there was some bubbling away of interest. The BBC love to commission things on anniversaries,
yes.
don't they? It has to be an anniversary.
Yeah.
But actually, you're so right, because it's a part of history that is so poorly explained and explored. And the numbers, when I started reading about it, my God,
yeah, they're mind-boggling.
We are talking the largest migration in recorded history. We're talking millions, potentially, of deaths. It's utterly shocking stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, it's shocking. But what shocked me more than that, really, was how few people knew about it. And I don't just mean, I had lots of people apologising, saying, Anita, we had no idea. I said, nobody needs to apologise. I had British Asian kids getting in touch with me via social media saying, we had no idea, we'd vaguely heard Granny say something, but nobody had really talked about it. Somebody even got in touch with me to say, Anita, I didn't realise Pakistan was once part of India. And I thought, how can this be?
So back to basics, isn't it?
So bad that this is being covered up or that no one knows. And that's where, it was after the Who Do You Think You Are that I went to the BBC and said, look, I would love to tell this story.
And they said yes.
Yeah.
And not only did they say yes, they did this in lovely format, which again, I think is down to you, but this idea of telling multiple stories from the different regions, that's a great idea.
Yeah, so it was obvious. I just felt, it was obvious to me that people should, for me, they should experience it is the way I experienced it.
Uh-huh.
Go and discover what you're, I know, there's so much, we're here for three generations now, and you know, lots of British Asian kids have never even set foot in India or Pakistan, let alone know about the history.
Mm.
So I thought, why don't I just find people who go through the experience that I had and learn something about their family, because that's the only way they'll feel it and really get to grips with what happened, because that's what happened to me. And I'd read a couple of books about partition, but knowing something intellectually and feeling it because it happened to you is, as we know, a completely different thing. So then how do you tell this vast bit of history? Well, you find the key players, one Muslim, one Sikh, one Hindu, and for me, crucially, someone had to be from a British colonial family.
That was the really exciting.
Yeah,
I loved it, that it was these layered narratives and all bringing it back to the real issue here, which is ideology, religion.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a bizarre thing that partition, the way that partition happened, that you are dividing people, moving them, format, but they're found because of their beliefs. And that was the stroke of genius, I think, with the format.
Mm.
But the stories were all equally traumatic. That was what was so interesting, you know.
Yes, and that's because it is a hugely, hugely traumatic rupture of a land and a people. So that was the thing, and that's the genius of the program makers, is that how do you, first of all, we know the stories are out there, but then finding stories that you can tell on BBC One as well, and that's the key, because the BBC Two is a slightly different audience. BBC One audience it's everybody, and you need to be able to communicate this in a way that everyone just is engaged with. And so you have to find the right characters and the right stories. But also, it couldn't just be, I mean, it was a very moving program, but there were moments of hope
as well. Absolutely.
And there was the moment where Benita, who's from a Bengali Muslim, a Hindu family, and she meets her family escape what later, as we know, became East Pakistan and the later Bangladesh by boat. And it's a Muslim father and his small son that helped the entire family escape by boat in the dead of night, covered them up, and they were stopped on the water. And they said, oh no, it's a Muslim family, you don't need to worry about these. It's making my hair stand
up. I know.
So they continue, and she went to Bangladesh and she met the little boy who saved her family.
Good,
I mean, so,
God.
Yeah. And I mean, it's making me well up just thinking about it. I'm not going to cry. You've seen me cry enough on telly.
It's seriously emotional stuff. And every story was traumatic. I want to talk a little bit about your family's story, because I got very emotional watching your response and your mum's response to the information that was coming out, but particularly when you met the older gentleman who had known her father. And that was... when he cried... I think there was a dry eye in the house. You're seeing this. He was in his 90s, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah.
And he was weeping over the things that he knew had happened around him.
I think that for me, meeting the elders, and particularly him, because what you don't know is, because there's only so much we can tell you in a one-hour TV show, is that he was in the Pakistani army. He was a commander. So he would have fought my granddad.
That's the subtext that came through in the interview.
Yeah.
You could see that there was regret and guilt and grief all wrapped up in his eyes.
When someone just looks you in the eyes, and every single person I spoke to, and this is, again, that generation who just don't do emotion, particularly the men, particularly that culture. And for him to just not be able to, none of them could even speak about it without bawling. And there was a phrase that he said that I will never forget, and he said, because I said to him, you know, tell me about it, and he said, how can I explain the loss of friends?
Yes.
He said, when you lose friends, he said, none of you will understand what that means. Like overnight to your best friends, you grew up with as brothers, and then you never see them again, ever. Mm. And also they will know what's happened to their land and what it meant, what it now means to live in Pakistan, what now living in Lahore means compared to what it was pre-partition. I mean, they would know. They know that there is, life has changed.
And I think that's what you managed to get across so profoundly. But this is recent history. To me, I don't think 70 years is a long time. The fact that that guy was not only alive, but then active, possibly even an active member of the army at that point, involved in those sorts of massacres, that means that, you know, he is a witness and a record alive of those events. And we are talking seriously traumatic stuff. So... if there are people in who didn't watch the program, just explain what you discovered about your family.
So the Who Do You Think You Are for me was left unfinished. I didn't get to go to Pakistan to see where my grandfather had lived. And one of the reasons is one of the sad, tragic legacies of partition is that if you're of Indian heritage, to get a visa to go to Pakistan, anyone else could probably get one. And vice versa, actually, of Pakistani heritage, getting into India, it's really easy. But for me to go... particularly as someone who works in telly, it took ages.
Did it?
It just took ages. So it took, a long time. Eventually got the visa for both me and mum. And all we knew is that my grandfather had lost his father, his two children, and his wife. And they told us that his wife had jumped into a well, because at that time, a lot of women, there was, as you can imagine, it was so brutal and so violent, and women were a weapon of war. And so rather than being raped or murdered by whoever, they were taking their own lives. And that's what we were told. And we were told that, my great-grandfather was killed coming out of the village. So I went to find out. First of all, we got to the village where they lived. And for the first time, my mother, who, quite honestly, as siblings, they never talk about my grandfather's previous life. They just talk about their upbringing. I don't think she'd ever thought in her life that this would happen to her, that she would go and see where he lived. I don't even think they really think about his life before. You know, they just kind of, oh yeah, he's our dad and he was in the army. they don't really think about the fact that he'd had a life and had lost everyone in his world. Yeah. So we enter the village, and there is an old gentleman who knew my grandfather, who was at school with him, and knew my great-grandfather. And my mother was just... I don't know what she must have felt. Mm. You know, I can only imagine what was going on with her. Mm. To then hear stories about her dad and her great and her grandfather, who by all means sounds like he was quite a dude, which is always nice to hear. Yeah, they were doing all right for themselves. But they didn't die in that house. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that was the other thing. It was detective work taking place almost while you were there, wasn't it, when you were making this? You were discovering, once you got to the village, that in fact, it was further down, wasn't it?
Yes. So at that time, what I learnt, one thing that the British were doing just pre the end of the Raj was this fantastic irrigation network, this system of canals that were being built in Punjab, which Punjab, the northern state of India, I'm sure most of you know, I'm sitting amongst people who, well, you're here for a reason, obviously, so you will know that much. But it's the breadbasket of India and, at that point, Pakistan, very fertile, rich land. And the British were building a system of canals to irrigate this beautiful land. And my great-grandfather actually migrated there from another part of India to work on the land. And people live within villages, and each village was called a chak. And this district had the most wonderful Punjabi name, Montgomery District. Oh. Great Punjabi name, Montgomery District. But so they all lived in these chaks, and each chak had a number, and they lived in chak 45. And that was a predominantly Hindu and Sikh chak. But there were Muslim chaks all around, and very close network of villages. They're not kind of, it's not like here in Cheltenham, but you know, it's just kind of neighboring. And each little chak would have its own well and its own local shop and all the rest of it. Mm. And basically what happened is the chaos and violence, and they had already started. Actually, they left it a bit late. Mm. Partition had already happened, and they were still there.
Yeah.
And they were told, right, go to the next chak 47. There's a very, very wealthy Sikh man who used to be in the army. He's got this quite big manor house, I suppose. It's called a haveli, which is quite a wealthy, kind of strong house. All the Hindu and Sikh families are going there to take refuge. So they went, and it was 1,500 people, women, children, and men. And essentially, they barricaded themselves into this house. And they were there for 3 days. There was a standoff. And because this Sikh gentleman who owned this property was in the army, I think they had a few weapons, had some guns. Mm. And I just let all the little details I discovered. They built, they dug a moat around it in the dead of the night. I don't know how they did it. And they basically got one of the canals to fill the moat. I mean, it was really,
God, siege warfare.
And it wasn't, this isn't just word of mouth. There was written documentation. One of the historians brought this remarkably, there's actually so much written about this period, and people were documenting it at the time, it's just finding it. But eventually, after 3 days, they couldn't hold it any longer because there were just so many Muslim families, and they got through, and they were, I mean, it's not pretty, they were butchered, essentially. Yeah. And I was told that the pretty young women were taken, and no one knows.
Nobody knows. I mean, that's... It's just,
I'm so
it's
sorry. I feel like
the stands.
There's no kind of. There is obviously joy, but I feel like I need to apologise to everybody that it's so dark and depressing.
It's so dark, but the reality is that I find it utterly fascinating, because not only does it shed light on this particular situation in Indian partition, but in a way it's such a real tale of the traumas of war and the traumas that people. All our ancestors, in funny, you know, we've all gone through
Absolutely.
This sort of trauma. But to be able to tangibly get to it like you have, to have that opportunity,
it's
both deeply disturbing, but I imagine quite enriching too.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely enriching. So I said, you know, initially, it's ridiculous to think about it now that I even thought, I was like, oh, who do you think you are? Well, I don't know. What else? And now here I am, and it's enriched me. I feel so much more grounded. I feel like knowing that this is not only the trauma that my family went through, but I feel like I can honor those women that, you know, my grandfather's first wife, who conveniently nobody wanted to talk about for the last 70 years, because it's just not something that anybody really wants to have to face, what their family... And I feel like, finally, as a young British woman, who my parents brought me up to be empowered and outspoken, I can say, you know what, sod shame. Yeah. Actually, women suffered horrendously, and I think somebody needs to talk about what they went through, and nobody has, as is the case of so much history.
It is, and it's uncomfortable, and it forces people to face these injustices. But actually, by talking it through, so many more stories are coming to light, aren't they? Your story was a sort of a touch paper for all these different other tales of partition that are coming out. But did you feel that people were deliberately covering up their experiences? And as you mentioned, sort of shame.
Yeah.
Was there a sense of shame?
Yes, I think so. I think that's just because it's part of the culture of that land, and particularly women, especially still sometimes to this day a little bit, but particularly 70 years ago, are seen as ridiculously the honour of the family.
Yeah.
And anything that would taint that... For the same reason that... So women, what I do know is that thousands, and I read a book, and the figure was 75,000 women, were kidnapped and kept, actually, on each side of the border. And what happened was a lot of women then, because they had children, because they would have been raped and got pregnant, and then sometimes converted and essentially and married and stayed. So Sikh women... We know that this happened because the first thing, ridiculously, that each country did post-partition, Pakistan and India, was like, let's repatriate those women. And it took years. And now you've got a woman who is from a Sikh family, let's say, in India, who's lived for 10 years in Pakistan as a Muslim woman. She's got a 10-year-old child, and they've gone, okay, your child can stay here, but we're going to take your back to... And her parents, they take her back to India, and they'd be like, well, we don't want to know you because you're... Utterly tainted. I mean, there's so much. If this happened here, we would have a documentary on every night about what happened.
Yeah.
There is just so much that I've discovered, and I'm still discovering from making this program, that is so shocking and appalling. But, like you say, the shame and started to happen. But the reason, I think, is there's shame. There's a lot of shame. But I actually think the other reason it's never been spoken about is... How do you even begin to talk about something so horrific? And the point, 14th of August, 1914, Pakistan, 1915, Indian independence. 14th of August, Pakistan, 15th of August, Indian independence. You've got the birth of a nation, the celebration of independence. Where do you fit in?
Yeah. The horror.
Yeah. Yeah, where do you fit that in? Nobody... There is no memorial in any country, not in Britain, not in India, not in Pakistan. I don't know. I think it was just like a collective silence. Like, okay, we all know that happened, but no one's going to talk about it.
This is why I'm so... I think all of us are so grateful to you for making this happen and getting the conversation started, because it's like it is one of these things that I think is so important about studying history, how we study it. It's not about a date, it's not about an act, it's not about a piece of paper. What we're showing here are millions of lives, individual lives, and each one is affected differently, but that's the story we want to be hearing now.
Back of it. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's the reaction. They've got such an amazing reaction off the back of it. Again, I'm overwhelmed. Mm. But the best thing for me, and I guess this is the reason I made it, and this is why I love television, like, this is why we get into it, right? That I've had so many letters, handwritten letters. How wonderful is that? Handwritten,
proper handwritten
actual
letters.
Pen, ink. I think someone, or on Twitter, saying... I finally, for the first time in my life, spoke to granny, or mum has just revealed something. Happened with my own in-laws. And my mother-in-law was like, oh, well, I might as well tell you about what happened.
Really?
So it's just sparked conversation. And I remember saying, if one person says that it's made them ask a question within their family, then that's great. But it seems that it's kind of, and also beyond that, not just amongst the British Asian community or anybody that was involved in India, so many people are saying, why do we not know this? This is a huge part of British history. This is empire. This is the end of empire. Why are we not talking about what happened
when it ended.
And it is one of these things, again, I think we sort of say, oh, brilliant, you know, the empire ended, Britain got out, go, creation of India, creation of Pakistan, fantastic. And then there is this daily horror that is the ripple of that.
Yeah.
I think this idea that it's based on religious lines as well.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a problem too, isn't it? It's so divisive. You've got people, I mean, your own story, the idea that you needed a visa to get into the village where...
Yeah, you know. It's ridiculous. And the most ridiculous thing about it is that it happened in a place like Punjab or anywhere in India. You know, India, well, to this day, okay, without getting into politics, modern day politics, but, you know, certainly at the time, it's a plural society. There are so many religions that live side by side and have done for centuries, forever,
for,
you know, however long. And Punjab, this state, which was a golden state. It was the last state. I mean, I'm sure there are people more learned than me in the room, but to be annexed by the British. And it was the sort of military, not only the breadbasket, the military hub. World War I, 1 million Indian soldiers. World War II, 2 million. And the vast majority were Punjabi Sikh men who they came from these kind of rural families. So you've got all of that going on, but there were Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs all living side by side. And believe me when I say the food is identical. The language, Punjabi, doesn't matter if you're Hindu or Muslim, you speak it exactly the same way.
Gosh, yeah.
The clothes they wear, like the pre-wedding songs, the folk culture is the same. The only difference is the god that you pray to.
Yeah.
So in my mind, the idea that this then becomes a reason to divide somewhere is bonkers. When I go to Punjab, and I'm lucky that I've been going to India since I was 2.
Great.
So I've had this really lovely kind of dual understanding of my culture. And I remember whenever we go to Punjab in India, whenever I go to the village in my mum's family ended up, there is a Muslim shrine. Like when kind of notable Muslims die, they create a sort of burial area, which is then shrouded in green material, and it's seen as a sacred place. Mm. That if you tie a little red ribbon, you make a wish and it will come true, and it's somewhere you go to pay your respects. I've done that my whole life. Mm. The idea that I wouldn't go to a Muslim shrine or a Hindu temple or a Sikh Gurdwara makes no sense to me. Like, I would naturally do all three because that's a Punjabi culture. So the idea that then you can just go... Actually, I read a really cool, funny article the other day that somebody wrote in an Indian newspaper. And it was, they were saying, how about Britain with post-Brexit? Here's an idea. Draw a division, and all the Remainers go to one side. And it was so brilliant. Yeah. I'm going to send it to you. You should read it.
God,
put it on your
yeah.
Twitter, and then you can all read Nina's Twitter. And it was brilliant. And it basically was like, yeah, that's how ridiculous
that's exactly it.
That's ridiculous. That's how, yeah.
That's such a good comparison. Yeah.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermes, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I mean, I found it absolutely bonkers. So I was doing some reading up, and I was looking at the maps that the British Raj were using in order to designate the lines,
yeah.
At which point there's, you know, greater amounts of Muslims on one side, greater amount of Hindus on the others. The Sikhs, of course, you know, they are concentrated, but they are scattered as well.
Yeah.
And it's just, to me, it's just such empiricism. The idea that, well, I have a graph,
yes.
And it shows that it's more on this side than there,
yeah.
So let's stick a line along here. It really upset me looking at those old maps.
It gets better when you hear the chap that they brought over, Sir Cyril Radcliffe, to draw this line, had never set foot in India. He knew nothing about maps. He'd never been to India. He was a lawyer. And they brought him over and went, right, mate, you've got 6 weeks. There you go. You've got one Hindu and one Muslim just to try and keep it nice and balanced to help you out. But 6 weeks' time, jolly good. Let us know what you've decided. I mean, talk about the most pressure that poor chap was put under.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the worst job in history has to be.
Yeah.
I would not
want to be that guy.
And
no, you wouldn't.
And then what happened at the end of it? I mean, it's just, it's farcical, really, isn't it?
It is, but it continues to have its ripples. You know, that's one of the upsetting things as well, is that there is still great division in attitude, really, isn't there, between India and Pakistan? Is that
huge. Post-partition, there were two wars between India and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. So there you go. My grandfather, whose family died there, then finds himself, because he's still in the army, commanding wars with them. Kashmir, the legacy, the bit that they decided they couldn't... never mind, we'll just leave that.
Don't know what to do with it.
This won't come
back on us.
Cricket, okay?
Be fine, just
They'll
leave
figure
it there.
It out. cricket, okay? You know, to India and Pakistan... Pakistan can't play cricket in India.
Yeah.
The Pakistani team can't. They play the big match that happened recently in the UK was huge because it's the first time India and Pakistan have played, because they can't play in each other's countries.
Yeah.
I mean, there's so much nonsense. But what I discovered when I went to Pakistan, which I can't believe I've been to Lahore, I've been wanting to go to this place. You know, they called it the Paris of the East.
Yeah.
And believe me, it is beautiful. Oh, yeah. As a historian, my God.
Oh, my tongue, yeah.
It's just stunning. And but people are people. People are people. And the people feel a sense of loss.
Right.
It's like, you know, because... Yeah, the culture is so much richer, as we know, when there's just, you've got difference and other, it's been, and actually, interestingly, the amount of people I met when I was in Lahore who said, you know, three generations, we were converted, and we were Hindus, and so there's all of that as well. You've only been Muslim for three generations, and now all of a sudden
I mean, I think it's amazing because it blows the lid on so many things. I was so excited watching your programs because I just thought my head was pinging off in every single direction.
As is mine, as you can
tell. Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about the situation in the Middle East, but I was also thinking about the situation with the fragmentations of countries like Yugoslavia and all these things that we can trace right the way back through history. And it also made me think about my own background. I feel exactly the same way as you about my past being immigrant stock. I don't care really what went before because I feel like we're going forward.
Yeah.
I don't think about. Well, I think it's different if you know you're going to inherit something from someone when they die. My family would just made something of themselves and keep going forward. But actually, watching it, I thought, actually, I want to know now.
Yeah.
I want to know about the trauma, and I know it's traumatic, because it is, it has to be. It goes back to war, and it goes back to division, and there's reasons people migrate on a big scale. Often because of trauma.
And
it's going to be traumatic. And I think you were so brave to go through that trauma. Has it left an echo? Do you feel like still sad? Do you still feel sad about it?
It's interesting you're going to say that, because they talk about the echo of trauma that kind of carries through generations. And I'm no psychologist, and I don't really know. Do I feel sad about it? It's really interesting. I think having never met my grandfather, because he died 6 months before my mum got married, and I feel like more than his children, I feel his pain. Mm. It's this weird feeling I have where it's like, my God, Grandad, and you kept it all to yourself, and no, you never talked about it. And even more bizarre than that, his first wife, who's even more removed from me, I feel like it's my duty. It's my duty to kind of make sure that she's honoured, that we kind of people...
You could see that in the programme. You and your mum had very different agendas on that trip,
didn't
you?
Yeah, massively. I'm glad you saw that. Yeah, it's true.
I could see you were feeling... And I mean, I could understand why your mum might not necessarily feel that connection, but you were feeling for her as a woman who killed herself to protect herself, almost.
Yeah.
And I could really see that your mum... What was your mum more interested in, you think?
She wanted to know... about her dad. Uh-huh. It was nice for her to see. And this is the honest truth, because that was a Sikh heartland. Mm. And for Sikhs, it was quite a major deal that Punjab was split into. Mm-hmm. What I didn't know was there are 300 Sikh temples still in Pakistan. Actually, it's quite a major pilgrimage for Sikhs to get to go to. There was a couple of places, Nankana Sahib, which is the birthplace of the first guru. My mum, to this day, she'll phone me up and go, "You made that happen for me.
Oh.
You made that happen for me. I never thought in my life." So for her, it was quite important
to kind of...
I also met... I mean, this is another documentary for another day. Maybe we need to talk about that. There are 2,000 Sikh families who were Pakistani Sikhs who never left, because in Peshawar, which is in the northeast, like that kind of region towards Afghanistan, they didn't even hear the partition was happening. They didn't get to them. So they've then gone, where have all the Sikhs gone? Lahore's a bit different.
Where is everyone?
So they, exactly.
Oh no.
And there's this other remarkable story about how they stayed, and some converted and others didn't. And there is now, and I met the first Sikh member of the Pakistani army.
No way.
So there's a whole new history, a whole new interesting bit of Sikh.
Where it goes.
Yes.
And the strands. I mean, that's it. It's just, that's why I think it's so interesting thinking about sort of cultural history and the way that you see these things. Yes, it's ideological, it's religious, but you described all these things. Food, music, writing, song. When it comes down to it, that's culture, and that's actually something that never gets really explained in history as much, does it?
And I have to say, it was really important for me to make this programme another one of my agendas. Not that it's cool to say that, but there was. I wanted people to know, I wanted British Asian kids to know, but I really wanted British Asian kids, particularly young Sikh children, to know that you are really similar to Pakistani Muslim children. That actually this weird, and I sense this kind of growing divide. Yep. And they've never set foot in India, and yet they have these opinions and feelings. And I just wanted them to know that 70 years ago, we all lived together.
Absolutely.
And like you need to kind of, and the only way, and I just feel it's dangerous. I've just sensed there are things happening that just worry me, concern me.
But it's so valuable. I mean, I went to school in Slough, and I remember the day when the Sikh Muslim riots happened on our street. And we were at one end of the street. I could see it. And they were absolutely going for each other.
You're a Slough girl. She's part Punjabi. Never mind.
No, yeah, and it was so real. It was terrifying because it was actually, you know, they were stabbing each other. They were really, really, really real. And I was like 15, 16, I didn't really understand why they hated each other so much. And it's to sort of open it up and say, this is the reason, but now we know the reason, what's the solution going forward? And that's what you're doing, aren't you?
Oh, I hope so.
I mean,
I don't know, it's only a TV show, but, you know, it's just put it into context, you know, just for people to just see it, that, you know, the families went through traumatic stuff.
Yeah.
And for all this stuff about the bloodshed, and yes, absolutely, Sikhs and Muslims and Hindus were killing each other, there were actually moments of families protecting each other
exactly.
as well, and going, you know what, you are our friends, you are like family to us, and we are going to help you. There was all of that happening as well.
It was so obvious when you were again interviewing the 90-year-old man that he the way he said we sat next to each other at school, you know, the idea that their desks were next to each other, and they were, like you say, friends, and to lose a friend, that's what it was coming back to, that there was so much commonality. It didn't even matter that they didn't believe in the same things. They were friends.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. They were friends. And that's what makes it so mad that this happens. But like you say, you know, it happens time and time again throughout history.
Yeah.
Genocide and neighbours, friends. And that is the most difficult thing and the hardest thing to understand about humans, I guess.
It's just
the hardest. And that's why it makes it hard to talk about it.
Yeah.
And that's why I think after my Who Do You Think You Are, I had this moment where I was filming for Countryfile and I was in the Covent Garden flower market. And it was 4 o'clock in the morning because all the flower marketeers are there, burly kind of East London types. And this massive bloke came up to me and he grabbed my hands. And I thought, oh, here we go. He wants to talk about Strictly.
Ah.
And he went, Anita Arney. And I just went, and he went, your story about partition is one of the most moving things I've ever seen. And he said, I connected to the humanity in such a profound way. And then he said, and he was this massive bloke, he said, I can't even talk to you without wanting to cry.
Oh my gosh. He said,
I can't say anymore. And he had to leave me. And I think that is why this, it's not just people saying, how did we not know about this moment in history? It's because we want to know, like, this is human history. You know, it's,
we want to understand what it is to be human. It's just an ongoing journey, isn't it?
Yeah.
But, I mean, it was amazing. We're going to leave some time for questions.
Yeah,
We've talked so much.
Yeah, we talk a lot.
I could talk to you forever, obviously.
Yeah, we will. But not here.
But not
we'll
here.
We'll carry on.
Please, everybody, can we just put our hands together? This has been moving and amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
Amazing. Oh, my goodness. My emotions are ragged this evening. Absolutely ragged. Right.
For a hardcore northerner, you know, I'm kind of becoming very emotional these days. But, yes, I would love to.
Right. Where's our microphone? Over there. Let's get some hands up. There's a gentleman. We've got quite a few hands up. Can we start with this gentleman here, please? Just there. Thank you very much.
Working. There's a very moving story that you've told, and I did watch your programmes, and they're brilliant. But what I found really intriguing is that no one blames anybody. You know, does anybody say it was Churchill's fault, or Nehru's, or Gandhi's, or, you know, nobody ever blames. And I think that's quite wonderful, that they don't actually point any finger and say it was all your fault.
Yeah.
Did you ever come across any of that when you were talking to these people?
No, and that is, it's a really interesting point, and it's a good observation, actually, and that's the truth of it. First of all, Asian families just don't talk about it. Mm. But certainly when they do, maybe the elders or whatever, nobody ever gets into the politics of it, because I think that's why this program was the right way of making it and seeing it from the perspective of actually what happened to the people. And ultimately, because the people didn't care. Mm. They didn't care who was to blame. It just happened. I'm sure people do have their opinions, definitely. But ultimately, you know, it's certainly not something that I've heard conversation. Just put it this way. My grandfather, we had a dog. I don't know if I should say this, but no, I won't. Okay, my husband's just looked at me saying
it. He knows what it is. He knows the story.
Okay, I think people do have their opinions, definitely, and they do blame politicians, but it's just not the main... When we talk about partition, I just don't think it's the first thing that comes to people's minds. I think there... But if you were to sit down with anybody who had an opinion about it, they would probably get into it with Jinnah and Nehru and Gandhi, of course. Mm. Of course.
Mm. And, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, that's a really good observation, actually.
Yeah.
I thought the same thing, that there was a sense of just grief and regret and almost this sort of accidental horror of it.
Yeah. And it is one thing that I thought, and a few people have asked me, oh, should it have happened and who's to blame? Like, the politics of it is so complex. But I do feel that, you know, if you've run a country for 200 years and you're about to leave, just deal with it delicately. I just feel that, you know, you talk about blame, and I'm not here to, you know, it's history is history, as we all know, but there is a responsibility on a country that has ruled for 200 years, and cutting and running, it's difficult. I think it's I think that is the biggest thing that we need to now talk about, sort of legacy of empire. It's difficult. It's difficult for me to even say it, but you've got to. Yeah, it was dealt with. It was mismanaged. Let's put it that way. It was mismanaged.
Yeah.
But yes, should it? Yeah. Yes.
Excellent. Mm. Right, we had another question. This lovely lady here. Fantastic. Aren't you all being good waiting for the microphone?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Your programmes were incredibly moving.
Thank you.
Two of the phrases I absolutely hate are, lessons will be learnt from this, and we learn from history, because very often neither of those are true. One of the things I found really puzzling in the programme was what happened to Lahore, that they didn't actually decide what was going to happen to Lahore and change their mind. What was that all about?
What, in what mean?
Well, as I remember it, and forgive me if I'm wrong, that at one point Lahore was going to be on one side
yes.
of the border, and then they changed their mind.
Yes, why
so
did they change their
mind? So what was that about?
Well, yes, I don't know. What were the conversations that took place? I mean, there are probably more of you in this room who know about it than I do, but I think they probably felt that Pakistan needed a major city. And Calcutta stayed in India because there was discussion about Calcutta going to East Pakistan. So I think Lahore was given to Pakistan. I think it was part of the deal that they needed a major city. And they say when Lahore went to Pakistan, people cried. Mm. And I know, having set foot in that city, being lucky enough to go there, you feel it. Yeah. It's steeped in history. And everyone's history, it's all there. And you imagine that, and it was so part of this Punjabi, this great state. So yeah, I think that's what happened. Mm. I think they went, right, well, okay, if we're gonna keep Calcutta, then Pakistan get Lahore, as simple as that. Mm. Yes, a barter.
Totally.
Exactly, yes.
A barter situation, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always trying to think about ways to relate it to what we would go through here, but it's like when you have the Danelaw and you have York up at the north.
Yeah.
That was grieved over.
Yes, yeah.
York was no longer part of...
Yeah.
I mean, this is so much more traumatic, isn't it? Because it is other people deciding, just drawing lines and deciding that goes that way.
Yeah. Yeah, but such pride in these places as well, you know. These are places that are not just... It's difficult to imagine. I'm still trying to relate it. How would we... How can we compare
it?
But because we're such a developed nation, it's so difficult to do. I mean, these were the cities, you know.
Absolutely.
Lahore. I've been to Amritsar, I've been to Jalandhar, I've been to every major city in Indian Punjab. Nothing is a patch on Lahore.
Really?
Nothing. I set foot in Lahore and I was like... Oh my God, I'm in the capital of Punjab.
Wow.
This is incredible. This is on another level. It's another city. Amritsar's not a patch on what Lahore is.
And then to not be able to access it, to not be able to get to it.
Yeah.
That is...
You can see why it would have broken people's hearts.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. Wonderful question. We've got another question up at the back there. Lovely. Thank you all. You just make its way over.
Hi, this is more of a statement than a question. First of all, thank you so much for coming to Gloucester.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You are one of my role models as a Punjabi person, woman in England. And looking at you the last couple of years, I know that I can do whatever I want
to
do.
Yes, you can.
thank you so much. I'm here with my mum, and we are both...
Hello, Mum.
We're both Pakistani Punjabis from Lahore, and watching your programme was one of the most emotional things that we've been through as a family all together. Luckily, we have talked about partition in our family, especially from my mum's dad's side. He passed away before I was born, so I wasn't able to ask him directly. And luckily, like you, I've been able to go back to Pakistan when I was a child and learn about it. I went back to Lahore 2 years ago for the first time in 11 years, and after learning about all the things, seeing, you know, Ranjit Singh's palace and his, you know, his shrine, everything is there, and the Sikh people are not there to see it.
Yep.
And you know, I went to Nanakana Sahib as well. Matha Tek, yeah, isi me uthe.
Yeah, good.
And for the first time ever, I've been to a Gurdwara. I went to Southwold, I've been all over the UK, I've never been to a Gurdwara. The first time I went was there. And the sense of peace and spirituality you feel in the temple of another religion is incredible. And it's what all India and Pakistan is about, living together in harmony. And I just wanted to say thank you so much for bringing that to light to a lot of my friends, my white friends, even my Sikh, Muslim, Hindu friends who didn't know about this or didn't talk about it in their families. It really means so much. And thank you so much for coming here and doing what you do and being who you are.
Thank you. Gosh, I'm so humbled.
Thank you.
That really means a lot.
Thank you.
I'm really struggling today. Thank you so much. I don't know how to take that, but I will with humility and say, I'm glad. You know what? If all I can do is empower British Asian girls and girls generally, that's awesome. I must say, I do drink quite a bit as well, so I'm not the best role model. Although you obviously don't drink because you're a good Pakistani. I don't know anyway. But you're right. You know. Yes, that means I make a joke of it because I obviously don't know how to cope with what
you just
said.
Because you're going to cry in a minute,
yes,
aren't you?
But yeah, and we'll talk later. But you know exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about Lahore then. What a place. And actually, what she just said about Ranjit Singh, this is a great story. You must get Anita Anand's book, I was going to say, about the Kohinoor. He was the king who had the Kohinoor diamond, and he was the last king of this great Punjabi empire, and it was his son Maharaja Daleep Singh that was brought to these shores at the age of 9 and converted to Christianity and was never allowed to set foot back ever again in India because they still feared that if he ever set foot back in Punjab he would regain he would take it. It's an amazing story. Maybe that'll be my next documentary.
Yes.
Good. I'm glad you've got your thumbs up.
Do it.
But that is the story of this Punjabi heartland. It is next to the main mosque in Lahore, right next to it is the Sikh temple.
Yeah.
And that is where that is his place, his samadhi. Yeah. And that was his court. Oh, I mean, the stories, God. They are magical. And that you would read them in a fairy tale and be blown away, but it's real, and it's not that old. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's that idea of just all of us are trying to do this through television, through communicating, but just broadening up knowledge of these places and stories that are directly relevant to British people.
That's exactly. Yeah,
they're not. It's not distant and far away. It's relevant and it matters.
Yeah.
And you're bringing it to people, and it's amazing. Yeah. Do we have another question? Go on, that window. Oh, hang on, where's the mic? Have you got the microphone? Could you bring it round? Because we want to hear Sat Winder speak. By the way,
I don't drink that much, by the way. Can I just say?
She's paranoid now.
I know. I'm like, what have I just said?
May I just firstly introduce the speaker who's about to talk to you for the moment? This is Sat Winder Semi. He is our calligrapher, and he made this on my arm today.
Yeah, beautiful.
And he is going to be in the scriptorium, breathing life back into the medieval scriptorium through his wonderful skills.
Thank you, Anita. What I just wanted to say was these stories have been around for ages and ages, but because the media doesn't cover them, they've not been made, they've not come to light. And it's thanks to you that they have. But these stories go further back than that. You know, Maharaja Daleep Singh, further back, the splitting up of Punjab, the land of five rivers, it all goes further and further back. But because there was no communication in India at the time, you know, it was just oral communication. And when the British left, they just put a full stop to it. And that was it. So the only history we've got is oral history that our parents and grandparents have passed down. But English history will not show that. Indian history books will show a different story.
Yeah.
So it's about time that the truth, we can learn from yesterday to make tomorrow better. Mm. And that's all we can hope for. So when these stories come out, the atrocities, we all know that, the Sikhs, you know, let's not go into religion or politics, but those atrocities did happen. They're documented. But it's about time they're brought out into the open and somebody should realise the suffering, the torture, and what has made us into a race that we are, of tolerant people, democratic people, with dignity and humanity, who will defend those who can't defend themselves. And that's why India is still alive. And why Pakistan was split up, there is reason for it. That's totally political. We won't go into that, but we can discuss that later. But thank you for bringing those and putting them into the media that is now...
Well, Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, you're right. It's not talked about. It's talked about even less. I mean, at least there are programs. I remember 10 years ago at the 60th anniversary watching Empire's Children, which I thought was all of a sudden. Mm. And I can't believe that, like, in my career, now I've all of a sudden made a program about my history that. And I'm here at the Gloucester History Festival talking about it. I mean, these are all little things that kind of have an out-of-body moment where it's like, wow, okay, that happened. But India and Pakistan talk about it even less. Let's remember that. You know, right. We say, you know, oh, British don't talk about it. India really doesn't talk about it. And my biggest hope is that this program gets syndicated and sold to India and Pakistan, and that actually people get to see it in those countries, because we kind of, and. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, these programs. Yeah, yeah. So at
but
least
they're. Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. If you could get it out into those
hopefully.
Formats, amazing.
Yes.
It's just the tip of the iceberg, really.
Yeah, yeah.
To start these conversations going. You're amazing. Okay, there was another hand up, wasn't there? Where do we have it? There's the gentleman there.
Thank you. I have it straight away. Well, my first question might be for Janina. Where should history begin? Should ours begin with Stonehenge, or about the colonialisation of Britain by the Saxons or the Normans? Yeah. Where does it begin in India? I mean, I understand that the British colonialisation and the empire was not by any means the first colonialisation of India. And all of these various colonialisations bring in a lot of religious baggage with them.
You're right, yes.
And that all seems to naturally follow with a sort of collective psychological impulse for division.
Mm.
And I think it's very difficult to actually apply blame to any one particular sector or to one particular time in history. As I say, it's something inherent in the human condition.
You
are
what
right.
An articulate way of expressing. I mean, I think you're right. I think if we look at it's one of the big bugbears in my life, you know. My name is Janina Ramirez.
It's
Polish
name.
First name, Spanish second name, Irish, Scottish, on, you know, I talk about British history. I make programs about British history. And yet, just in myself, I'm a complete hybrid and a mix. And so I just think it's arbitrary to try and impose this sense of, well, let's go back to the Anglo-Saxons beyond that. That's England. No, let's go back before that. That's England. History doesn't work like that. You're absolutely right. It is a continuum, and it's just changing and evolving. And I'm sure India has exactly that too, isn't it?
Absolutely. And you're right. So many different people have come to India and conquered, and Alexander was there. I mean, the reason why North Indians look so different to South Indians is because we were an absolute mixture of so many different waves of people coming in, the Mughals who came, and every person and people that come in bring their rich heritage and culture and architecture and all of that, and the legacies left behind. I think the reason why for me, and I think the reason why for most people who watch my program get so shocked by it, and maybe you as well, I don't know, is because it's such recent history and it's British history and it's only 70 years ago. And I think if that happened now, I mean, we know things are happening in the Middle East. I think we just we learn nothing from history. You are so right.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we hope that we are now in a position where at least our governments think, right, okay, what is the best way of dealing with this situation now? You know, I just think one of the things is it was such a cut and run. It was, and that was it. And it was like, let's get out quick.
Sure.
I think that's the reason why there is, for me, that is a discussion to be had or not. But yeah, that's the only thing that sticks in my throat a little bit.
Mm. Gosh, you know what? We've totally overrun.
I talk a lot, utterly
enthralling. I'm sure you all agree. Thank you from the bottom of my heart for coming to us.
Thanks for asking me.
And I hope you'll come back.
Yes.
And everybody, let's thank her again.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody.
Hold up. Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.